Welcome to Immigration Review, your weekly source for immigration case law updates and insights. I'm your host, Kevin A. Gregg, a partner with the law firm Kurzban, Kurzban, Tetzeli, and Pratt. Back again to review the week's precedential immigration cases, rummaging through the decisions so you don't have to. As always, this show does not constitute legal advice and has no bias other than to keep you up to date and enable you, my dear colleagues, to excel in court. So, without further ado, let's start the review. This week, I present to you the moment you've been waiting for 7 weeks. Episode 7 of Immigration Review. We've got a great lineup of cases for you this week, touching on controlled substances, the categorical approach, asylum, and even an unaccompanied minor case. Lots of losses for non-citizens this week, but we do have one win out of the Second Circuit. Hopefully from the adverse decisions, we'll glean some creative legal arguments. Now, on to the first case. The first case we're going to discuss this week is out of the Fifth Circuit, published on June 8, 2020, Alexis v. Barr. This case is primarily about the realistic probability test and its application to Texas's controlled substance laws, and it's a weird one. Judge Graves Jr. wrote the majority opinion, and then wrote a separate concurring opinion to essentially say that he didn't want to write the majority decision in the manner he did, but he felt like he had to, based on the Fifth Circuit's 2017 en banc decision, United States v. Castillo-Rivera. Judge Dennis, for his part, dissented. Here's what's going on. Mr. Alexis has been a lawful permanent resident, or LPR, since 1991, and pretty much his entire family, including his young daughter, are U.S. citizens. In 2016, he pled guilty to, and was sentenced to 1 year in prison for, violating a Texas statute that criminalizes possession of less than 1 gram of a controlled substance. DHS charged Mr. Alexis as removable under INA Section 237A2BI for having violated a law relating to a controlled substance, alleging that Mr. Alexis possessed cocaine. Mr. Alexis argued that he was not removable under this section because the Texas controlled substance list is broader than the federal controlled substance list, and in the alternative, that Texas's definition of cocaine is broader than the federal definition of cocaine. An immigration judge agreed that the Texas controlled substance list is broader than the federal list, but then found that the specific controlled substance is an element of the offense. And applying the modified categorical approach, the IJ found that Mr. Alexis possessed cocaine, thereby making him removable, because cocaine is listed in both the Texas statute and the federal controlled substance list. As to Mr. Alexis's argument that Texas's definition of cocaine itself is broader than the federal definition of cocaine, the IJ agreed, because the Texas list, unlike the federal list, includes cocaine isomers, which are a different chemical compound of cocaine. But the IJ then found that Mr. Alexis did not establish a realistic probability that Texas prosecutes individuals who possess isomers of cocaine. The IJ therefore found Mr. Alexis removable, and then denied his application for asylum from Trinidad, finding that his asserted particular social groups, based predominantly on his family membership, were not socially distinct or particular, as required under BIA case law. The BIA affirmed the IJ's decision. Mr. Alexis appealed to the Fifth Circuit and asked the Fifth Circuit to stay his removal while it decided his case. But the Fifth Circuit denied his stay request, and Mr. Alexis was physically deported. On petition for review, the Fifth Circuit affirmed the IJ and the BIA. It too recognized that Texas's definition of cocaine is broader than the federal definition. But the Fifth Circuit held that even if the statute is overbroad, under Fifth Circuit precedent, the non-citizen must point to his own case or another case to show that there is a realistic probability of prosecution in the overbroad matter. To quote the Fifth Circuit, there is, quote, no exception to the actual case requirement articulated in the Supreme Court's case Duenas-Alvarez, where a court concludes a state statute is broader on its face, end quote. Put another way, it doesn't matter that the plain text of the Texas definition of cocaine is overbroad. The realistic probability test still applies, which means that Mr. Alexis needs to find a case where Texas prosecutes possession of cocaine isomers. And quite frankly, it seems like Mr. Alexis came really close by citing to a lot of cases, including a 2006 Texas case, Evans v. Slate. The dissent certainly believes in this case that Mr. Alexis satisfied the realistic probability test. But ultimately, the majority distinguished Mr. Alexis's cited cases and affirmed his removal. The majority also denied Mr. Alexis's asylum and CAT claims in relatively unremarkable fashion. And those are the holdings. Mr. Alexis lost his case. But here are some observations on the Fifth Circuit's realistic probability and CAT analyses. Starting first with the CAT analysis. In the humble opinion of one podcast host, the Fifth Circuit may have erred in how it reviewed Mr. Alexis's CAT claims. The Fifth Circuit refused to review the facts underlying the claim because it believed, under the Supreme Court's recent decision, Guerrero-Lasprilla v. Barr, that Mr. Alexis's conviction stripped them of jurisdiction to review all facts except facts that are undisputed. In the humble opinion of one podcast host, Nasrallah v. Barr last week, instead requires the Fifth Circuit to review all CAT factual findings under the substantial evidence review standard. If that podcast host is right, the Fifth Circuit may be amending its judgment sometime soon. Turning to the realistic probability analysis. The Fifth Circuit's application of the realistic probability test, in this case, is directly at odds with the Second Circuit's application of the test 2 weeks ago in Williams v. Barr. The Second Circuit, and many other circuits, have held that where the plain text of a statute, as is the case here with Texas's definition of cocaine, is broader than the federal definition, here, the federal definition of cocaine, the realistic probability test has no role to play, and the analysis is over. The statute is overbroad. So we've got a circuit split. The Fifth Circuit's analysis in this case also creates a bit of an intra-circuit split in the Fifth Circuit itself. Under Mercado v. Lynch in 2016, the Fifth Circuit will not apply the realistic probability test when the offense at issue is a crime involving moral turpitude, or CIMT. But apparently the Fifth Circuit does require the application of the realistic probability test for all other criminal conviction analyses. As far as I can tell, there is no principled reason for this distinction, other than the fact that the Mercado Court believed itself bound by prior Fifth Circuit precedent on the narrow issue of CIMTs. Not mad at it, but also don't really understand it. Turning to Judge Graves Jr.'s concurrence, and again, remember, Judge Graves Jr. also wrote the majority opinion in this case. But in concurrence, writing only for himself, Judge Graves agrees that this case was dictated by controlling Fifth Circuit precedent. But he deems that precedent, quote, illogical and unfair, end quote, and agrees that the realistic probability test should not apply where the state statute is overbroad on its face. I know some circuits who would agree. Indeed, as Judge Graves Jr. explains in a detailed footnote filled with citations, the Fifth Circuit is alone among the circuits in its application of the realistic probability test, with the 1st, 2nd, 3rd, 4th, 9th, 10th, and 11th circuits declining to apply the realistic probability test where the statute is on its face overbroad. One last thing on this. Where circuits like the 5th are essentially turning the analysis on whether practitioners can find a case to meet the realistic probability test, immigration practitioners and criminal practitioners should work together in concert to develop a database of criminal charges and non-published cases for use as necessary. Indeed, in this very case, the Fifth Circuit recognized that due to how criminal convictions operate in Texas, quote, it is nearly impossible for Mr. Alexis to determine if Texas has ever prosecuted anyone for possession of isomers of cocaine in a citable state decision. Mr. Alexis is essentially in a catch-22 situation when it comes to meeting the realistic probability test, end quote. So the need is there for the private bar to create a database of criminal conviction cases. I believe AILA, or subchapters of AILA, are working on or have proposed such projects, and I think it would be extremely helpful. And that is Alexis v. Barr. The next case is Tejeda v. Barr, published by the Ninth Circuit on June 8, 2020. This case also concerns controlled substance laws, this time California's. It's a short case, and the issues are primarily legal. And it holds that California Health and Safety Code Section 11550A California's under the influence of a controlled substance law, is divisible as to the controlled substance at issue. As we just touched upon, to determine removability based on a controlled substance offense, the courts apply the categorical approach. And as we've discussed before, this requires courts to compare the elements of the criminal conviction to the elements of the federal offense. And when it comes to drug crimes, the analysis usually comes down to a comparison of the state controlled substance list with the federal controlled substance list. Here, like in most, if not all, states, California's controlled substance list covers more drugs than the federal list. So, if the California drug statute, Section 11550A, is not divisible as to the controlled substance, courts would be unable to ascertain the controlled substance at issue in the conviction, and the conviction would not be a removable offense. Much of the analysis in this case follows from the Ninth Circuit's 2014 decision Coronado v. Holder and its 2017 en banc decision United States v. Martinez-Lopez. In those cases, according to this panel, the Ninth Circuit held that each drug on California's controlled substance list constitutes an element that the prosecution must prove to obtain a controlled substance conviction in California. This means that for every crime involving a controlled substance in California, the prosecution must prove the specific controlled substance at issue. Therefore, because the controlled substance is an element of California's controlled substance crimes, this statute, like apparently all controlled substance statutes in California, is divisible, and the court can proceed to the modified categorical approach to ascertain the drug at issue. Applying the modified categorical approach, the Ninth Circuit reviewed the criminal charging documents, plea agreement, and minute order to determine that Mr. Tejeda was under the influence of amphetamine, a controlled substance listed on both the California and federal lists. Accordingly, Mr. Tejeda was found removable. Here are two quick notes before we conclude this case. First, this case is actually contrary to an unpublished 2014 decision from the Ninth Circuit, but as unpublished decisions do not hold precedential value, this case controls. Lastly, as an example of how many cases the Ninth Circuit adjudicates each year, and how long all of this can sometimes take, this case has been pending with the Ninth Circuit since 2013. And that is Tejeda v. Barr. Moving right along to the Second Circuit, we've got Martinez de Artiga v. Barr, published on June 10th, 2020. This is another MS-13 asylum case from El Salvador. It resulted in a remand for further fact-finding. Judge Kears dissented. In June 2014, the International Criminal Organization and Gang, MS-13, tried to recruit Ms. Martinez's 10-year-old son and threatened him multiple times at school. Ms. Martinez began escorting her son to school to stop the recruitment, and 2 weeks later, the gang confronted Ms. Martinez at her home, yelling that they would kill her and her son if her son didn't join MS-13. One of the gang members even displayed a knife in a threatening manner. Knowing MS-13's reputation, Ms. Martinez fled to the U.S. with her son within a week of the threat. MS-13 then began threatening her daughter in El Salvador to learn the whereabouts of Ms. Martinez and her son, telling her daughter that they'd turn her into a sex slave if she didn't divulge the location of Ms. Martinez. Later, MS-13 cornered her daughter in the forest and threatened to kill her. Ms. Martinez's daughter fled to the United States from El Salvador that very night and submitted an affidavit in Ms. Martinez's case to the IJ. In removal proceedings, the IJ found Ms. Martinez credible and that she had sufficiently corroborated her story, but he denied asylum because he found that MS-13 hadn't targeted Ms. Martinez based on her membership in her family, but rather because of her, quote, interferences with the gang's recruitment efforts, end quote. The IJ denied cat protection largely because Ms. Martinez fled after only being threatened one time. The BIA affirmed. The Second Circuit disagreed, at least regarding the cat findings, stating, quote, for the IJ or BIA to rule categorically that certain facts preclude cat protection may be erroneous as a matter of law, end quote. As the Second Circuit saw it, the IJ had held, quote, categorically that an applicant for cat relief must be threatened more than once, and that such a person must suffer physical harm before fleeing, end quote, and that such a rule is an error of law. For this primary reason, and supported by some other reasons, the Second Circuit remanded back to the BIA and expressly suggested remand to the IJ for further CAT and asylum analysis. In dissent, Judge Kearse primarily disagrees with the majority's reading of the IJ's decision and the record evidence. So, good news for Ms. Martinez. Here are some notes and observations. First, add this to the list of recent cases recognizing that MS-13 is a powerful and extremely dangerous organization, and that fear of which can provide grounds for asylum so long as the applicant establishes a nexus to a protected ground. Next, and curiously, this case was transferred from the Second Circuit's non-argument calendar to its argument calendar by a judge, indicating perhaps that one or more judges on the Second Circuit are tired of the many MS-13-based asylum denials. And finally, while it's not a circuit split per se, so don't cue the music, the majority noted that the Attorney General's 2019 analysis in matter of LEA II, making it exceedingly difficult for family-based particular social groups to succeed, is in tension with the Second Circuit's 2020 decision, Hernandez-Chacon v. Barr. The Second Circuit, however, declined to resolve the tension at this time. Put another way, the Second Circuit is saying, "I see you, Attorney General, but not today." And that is Martinez de Artiga v. Barr. The BIA also issued an asylum-type decision this week. Matter of FSN 28 INN Decision 1, published on June 12, 2020. As that citation makes clear, this is the first decision of Volume 28 of the BIA's published decision reporter. Legally irrelevant, but something that this case law nerd cannot help himself from noting. Publication of this case follows what's become a bit of a trend from the BIA of publishing decisions adverse to non-citizens on Friday afternoons. Not sure what the BIA's strategy is with that one. And in fact, I can't remember the last time the BIA issued a decision favorable to a non-citizen. It might have been in 2016. This case is about motions to reopen to apply for asylum based on changed country conditions. A bit of legal background. Non-citizens ordered removed by an IJ can appeal to the BIA. If the BIA affirms the removal order, and often, assuming the non-citizen is not physically removed from the U.S., the non-citizen can file a motion to reopen with the BIA. There are many rules to this and many bases to file a motion to reopen. For non-citizens whose asylum claims were previously denied, one of those bases is a showing that country conditions have materially changed such that the non-citizen now has a well-founded fear of persecution or torture. The theory goes that conditions may not have warranted asylum at the time of filing, but conditions have now gotten so bad since the BIA's decision that now the non-citizen's life is truly at risk. In this case, an IJ and then the BIA denied a non-citizen from Cameroon's asylum and torture application. A few years later, she moved to reopen her case based on changed country conditions in Cameroon. She submitted new affidavits from family and friends and new country condition evidence to meet her burden. But here's the catch. When the IJ and the BIA denied her application many years ago, the IJ and the BIA found the non-citizen to be not credible. That is, the BIA and the IJ found that she was not telling the truth. In this case, the BIA denied the motion to reopen and made new law in the process. The BIA held that because of the adverse credibility finding in the past, the non-citizen in this case must meet a higher standard to reopen her case. Quote, "To prevail on a motion to reopen alleging changed country conditions where the persecution claim was previously denied based on an adverse credibility finding, the respondent must either overcome the prior determination or show that the new claim is independent of the evidence that was found to be not credible," end quote. So some good and bad with that holding. On the one hand, a changed country condition motion to reopen where an adverse credibility finding exists must now additionally overcome that adverse credibility finding. No easy task, because remember, in all cases, the BIA will have already affirmed the adverse credibility finding. On the other hand, the BIA has provided an alternative route for such motions to succeed. if the new asylum claim asserted in the motion to reopen is independent of and not based on the same facts or theory as the initial asylum claim, the adverse credibility finding need not be overcome. Indeed, the adverse credibility finding would appear to be legally irrelevant in those circumstances. So that's the holding. The BIA has made it more difficult for many non-citizens to reopen their cases to reapply for asylum. Here are some observations. First, this case is written by temporary appellate immigration judge Marcos Gimotz. He is currently an immigration judge serving as a temporary member of the BIA. The current administration has expanded the use of temporary BIA members and has used current and former IJs, many appointed since 2017, to fill both temporary and permanent roles on the BIA. In fact, just looking at the BIA's list of current members, there are a lot of names missing and a lot of new names added over the last 3 years. More on the significant changes happening at the BIA available through a Google search. Getting to the substance of this decision. As the BIA makes clear in footnote 3, it will now be almost impossible for a changed country condition motion to reopen to succeed where there exists a prior adverse credibility finding, because the only way to overcome the adverse credibility finding, according to the BIA, will be to present previously unavailable evidence that, quote, refutes the validity and finality of the credibility determination, end quote. Again, pretty darn near impossible to meet, because the BIA has already affirmed the adverse cred ruling, and it will be pretty difficult to obtain new evidence that undermines a credibility finding made years in the past. But the circuits do not like categorical bars to relief from removal, particularly asylum, so we'll have to wait and see how this decision ages in the circuits. Consider, for example, this hypothetical. An individual claims to be gay and claims to have been harmed in his country because he is gay. The evidence clearly shows he's gay, but an IJ determines that the non-citizen was not credible regarding the past harm he suffered. Years later, the non-citizen's country institutes the death penalty for gay people. So the non-citizen files a motion to reopen based on changed country conditions. The BIA's decision in this case could be used to bar reopening because the motion is not based on an independent new claim. But I find it hard to believe that a circuit court would affirm that decision. And finally, there's an argument that everything about the heightened standard instituted by the BIA in this case is simply dicta. After all, at the end of the decision, the BIA holds that in any case, the respondent has not established changed circumstances in Cameroon to warrant reopening. So in other words, the non-citizen in this case failed to meet the standard that the BIA had used for at least 3 decades before this decision, meaning that there was no reason, as a matter of law, for the BIA to apply a new standard in this case. And that is a matter of FSN. The next case is Garcia v. Barr, published by the Sixth Circuit on June 8, 2020. This case is about unaccompanied children, asylum, jurisdiction, and the Convention Against Torture. It's a split decision, ruling in favor of the government, with a dissent that's longer than the opinion itself. Mr. Garcia entered the United States without authorization 8 days before his 18th birthday, and was determined to be a, quote, unaccompanied alien child, as defined at 6 U.S.C. section 279 G2. He was placed in removal proceedings, and over a year later, at the age of 19, he applied for asylum and related relief. An immigration judge, and then the BIA, denied his application, and he was physically removed to El Salvador. Before the Sixth Circuit, Mr. Garcia brought 3 challenges. First, he challenged the IJ's jurisdiction, or authority, to decide his asylum application in the first place. Under the relevant statute, USCIS, and not immigration judges, has initial jurisdiction over asylum applications filed by unaccompanied alien children. But according to the majority in this case, under Sixth Circuit precedent and the statute itself, for USCIS to have initial jurisdiction of the asylum application, the non-citizen must be an unaccompanied child at the time he files the asylum application, not simply when he enters the United States, as Mr. Garcia did. So the Sixth Circuit held that the IJ properly had jurisdiction to review Mr. Garcia's asylum application. In so holding, the Sixth Circuit agreed with the BIA's 2018 decision, matter of MACO. Second, Mr. Garcia challenged the IJ's denial of protection under the Torture Convention, or CAT, but the Sixth Circuit rejected the challenge, holding that the IJ properly applied the, quote, willful blindness standard applicable in the Sixth Circuit, and that the evidence did not compel a finding that the Salvadoran government was willfully blind to the torture Mr. Garcia fears from private actors in El Salvador. And finally, Mr. Garcia challenged the IJ's denial of his motion for a continuance to seek special immigrant juvenile status and adjustment to LPR status, which would have prevented his removal to El Salvador entirely. But the Sixth Circuit held that his motion was moot, because Mr. Garcia had already been removed from the United States. While a non-citizen's removal does not moot many issues on petition for review, the Sixth Circuit held that it did moot the issue in this case because, quote, removal proceedings have been completed, so there's nothing left to continue, end quote. And so, the majority denied Mr. Garcia's petition for review. Not a great holding for non-citizens, but now for some good stuff. To start, there are two significant quotes from the majority opinion. First, the majority states, quote, like other judges, immigration judges have the power to determine their own jurisdiction, end quote. This is a notable quote, because it appears to go against the Attorney General's recent decisions, such as matter of Thomas and Thompson, refusing to apply the full faith and credit clause in the U.S. Constitution in immigration court, because according to the Attorney General, IJs are not judges in a court, but rather are government officials in an agency. This quote also provides a foot in the door for practitioners to continue arguing that IJs have authority to determine that they lack jurisdiction, notwithstanding former Attorney General Sessions' limitation in matter of SOG and FDB, published in 2018. Next, the majority in this case also expressly stated that USCIS policy memorandum and procedures are not, quote, even binding legal authority, end quote, seemingly on anyone. So there's that. And in this vein, the majority made clear that, quote, whatever the policy said, it couldn't rewrite the plain terms of the statute, end quote. This is consistent with a theme discussed a few episodes ago on the podcast, that if a regulation or USCIS policy appears to expand or narrow a statute in a manner adverse to a non-citizen, practitioners should argue that the statute governs, notwithstanding any regulation or policy by USCIS or the Department of Justice. So those are some good quotes from the majority. Now on to the dissent. In dissent, Judge Merritt made clear that this case was much more complicated than the majority would have it seem. For example, Judge Merritt notes that less than 2 months after Mr. Garcia was physically deported, a federal district court judge in the District of Maryland, in JOP v. Department of Homeland Security, enjoined the new USCIS policy that had resulted in Mr. Garcia's removal in the first place. Under the new USCIS policy made official in 2019, USCIS, for the first time, was required to decline jurisdiction over an asylum application if the non-citizen is no longer an unaccompanied minor at the time of filing. Or in Judge Merritt's words, the new USCIS policy, quote, usurped without notice the rights of unaccompanied alien children filing an asylum application after turning 18, end quote. And because of the injunction, the previous policy that would have allowed Mr. Garcia to have USCIS adjudicate his asylum application is currently in place. Judge Merritt also disagrees with the majority's reading of the plain text of the statute, and would order Mr. Garcia paroled back into the United States to have USCIS decide, in a non-adversarial proceeding, his asylum application in the first instance. Indeed, due to the current Maryland court injunction, if the facts of this case happen today, USCIS may very well have adjudicated Mr. Garcia's asylum application. And that is Garcia v. Barr. So there you have it. You're all caught up with the past week's published immigration cases. I'm Kevin A. Gregg, a partner with the law firm Kurzban, Kurzban, Tetzeli, and Pratt, and this has been another episode of Immigration Review. Thank you for listening, and I hope you enjoyed it. If you did, please share it with a friend and rate and review us. Each review helps new listeners find the show. And of course, subscribe to Immigration Review wherever you get your podcasts. For questions, comments, or anything at all, email me at kgregg@kktplaw.com. That's K-G-R-E-G-G at kktplaw.com. And follow us on Instagram and Facebook at Immigration Review, and send us a tweet at imreview. That's I-M-M review. I'll be back next Monday for a brand new discussion. Until then, I'm Kevin A. Gregg, bringing you the Immigration Review.